Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Jonathan Curiel, your moderator for tonight's program called Afghanistan, Current Challenges and Future Projects. We also welcome our listening and internet audiences and invite everyone to visit us online at www.commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my extreme pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker, Dr. Mohammed Kayomi. Dr. Kayomi is an engineer and professor who currently serves as chief advisor on infrastructure and technology to the president of Afghanistan. He previously served as president of San Jose State University, where he was appointed in 2011. And before that, he served as the fourth president of Cal State University East Bay. Dr. Kayomi was born in Afghanistan, and he was the first person of Afghan descent to head a major U.S. university. He has a very distinguished career, and it's my extreme pleasure to welcome Dr. Kayomi.
Thank you. Well, hello, everyone. It's a pleasure to be with all of you, and thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about Afghanistan. First of all, on behalf of the Afghan people and the government of Afghanistan, I would like to thank U.S. for all of the support that and the generosity of America for Afghanistan. Specifically, I would like to pay a special tribute to the U.S. Armed Forces in Afghanistan, specifically more than 4,600 people who paid the ultimate price and serving freedom and fighting again, alongside Afghan soldiers. The Afghan people would always be indebted to their service, to their dedication, and the sacrifices that they and their families have done. I think, you know, but even when we look at today, in some ways, the fighting has not been finished yet. Although the combat mission of the arm, of the foreign forces ended over 15 months ago in December of 2015, the Afghan forces have been doing all of the fighting. The number of foreign forces dropped by about 90%. It's we have about 10,000 soldiers right now, because contrast to over 100,000 during the surge period. The role of the foreign forces are primarily training as well as logistical support. But as far as all of the actual fighting is concerned, that is done by the Afghan forces. And there's hardly a night that they are not they do not fight the enemy in battles somewhere between 15 to 20 different sites. Casualties, you know, they have casualties, but the good thing is, even till today, with all of that, there has not been a problem in recruitment of young soldiers, and they feel that this is part of the duty, of their duty to fight for the homeland and trying to keep that secure. I think one of the other aspects that we need to remember about the fight in Afghanistan, that as to how it really connects to the to what's happening all around the region, that region and the world in a way. If you really look at the role of global terrorism and what it has really happened in, since 9/11, we see a major change in the ecology, in the pathology and morphology of global terrorism. First of all, when you look at this ecology, how it has really become part of networks, and all of these networks are far more connected than and meets the eye, and how as part of this $1.7 trillion of illicit economy globally, whether it starts from the narcotics to human trafficking to trafficking of all kinds of antiques to all the way to terrorist groups. They're all part of the same continuum. These are groups that, for different purposes, they join hands, and sometimes they cooperate, and sometimes they compete. In Afghanistan area, we have the highest concentration of global terrorist organizations, more than 20 of them. So it's not only the fight of the Afghan soldiers are not only fighting for their own country, but I think they are fighting as part of the how they combating the global terrorism. So we have, you know, whether we, you know, as I said, more than 20 countries, you know, starting from Russia, from China, from Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, many of the Arab countries, and of course a large number from Pakistan, all fighting in Afghanistan. And that basically is what the Afghan soldiers are fighting. Mentioned about the pathology of the terrorist organization. I think part of what you really see is that how it from the 9/11 days, how it has really changed in the sense that the role of these groups have been, basically fighting for total destruction, basically fighting for destroying the kind of the Western life that many of us know, basically trying to break the bond between governments and its citizens. And what are some of the key bonds of that one? Basically, the providing security, ease of movement, ease of travel, and those are the kind of things that they have really been fighting. So if you look at many of these 20 countries, you'll wonder what do they have against Afghanistan or why they are even there. But this is part of the pathology of what they've been trying to look at globally. And the last element will be is that how they have really morphed from the days of Al-Qaeda to ISIS and Daesh groups. And part of it is how they have become so far more nimble and the pace of change in those groups have been so tremendous. I think the kind of changes that the destructive forces that they were that took Al-Qaeda over a decade, and in ISIS and Daesh case, we really saw that same kind of destructive force develop in less than a year or so. So I think these are some of the dynamics that we really need to keep in mind. Well, getting back to Afghanistan and basically the current regime took over since about 2 years ago. And when it took power, this was a difficult time in Afghanistan. It took power at the time, despite the billions of dollars that had been poured in Afghanistan. There was not any kind of, the former regime did not have any type of a serious economic agenda. So as part of it, the economy was very much based on a consumptive economy. And the current regime, their first view was how they can really build a program of self-reliance where, the idea was that how the country can stand on its own 2 feet and be able to meet the needs of its citizens. So basically, it concentrated its efforts on 4 key areas, getting back to the brilliant basics on what the country needs to grow, what it needs to extract from its minerals, what it needs to, in terms of trade, to do trade, and what they need to manufacture. And those basic 4 elements made the framework of the country's economic plans. So on the first element, in terms of grow. If you look at Afghanistan, was very much an agricultural country, but developing the dubious distinction of importing foods, by several billion dollars, it became one of those countries where the food is going from the cities to the countryside. So that's one of the key things that needed to be changed. And by the way, when the current government took over, the country's imports were 21 times more than its exports. And how on earth you can really have a country that you can keep employment and you be able to thrive and move forward. So along that line, the idea was identifying what are the cash crops that they need to, and then also, very much like California being a very dry climate, all of the agriculture depends on the type of irrigation that you need. But a lot of the canals, a lot of the irrigation systems had been destroyed over time and not much had been built. Last year, that was the first year that the country finished one major dam. This was the first dam that was finished in 40 years. It's a modest-sized dam, holds about 650 million cubic meters of water. Within the past year, as part of the infrastructure, we made plans for about 21 dams that construction is in different phases, some in design and some we've the construction has started. and then looking at all of those canals. Another aspect of the irrigation was the fact that because of the global the climate changes and global warming, compared to 30 years ago, the snow melt in Afghanistan about 3 weeks quicker than it used to at that time. So dams were becoming even more important than it used to be. With all of these dams are built within the next 3 to 4 years, collectively the amount of water that can withhold will be equivalent to about 4 to 5 Hoover dams. So it's a sizable amount of water. Afghanistan is blessed with a good amount of water, basically of the six countries that are bordering Afghanistan. We are the upper riparian for 5 of those countries. Another aspect of agriculture was how to really begin identifying cash crops that would really be helpful. And although we grow a lot of wheat, but it's, of course, wheat, compared to some of our northern neighbors, we cannot really compete along that line. So developing cash crops such as saffron, pistachios, pine nuts, and a number of other ones have really become key elements. For instance, just last year, they were able to increase their saffron production by over 50%. Of course, it's not that you can get the balance of payment finalized by saffron, but now is the fourth largest exporter of saffron in the world. The same way, if we look at extractive materials, Afghanistan is blessed with a lot of extractive resources, and the good thing is that it's all over the country. It's not in one spot of the country. So we looked at dividing that one in a number of key areas. First, in oil and gas. Those are the easier ones to really develop, and we've developed some of those ones and trying to see how we can contract them. The second key area is a lot of construction material. Afghanistan has, for instance, 42 different types of marbles. 50 different kinds of marbles, 42 different colors, and some rivaling Italian marble. But the idea is how we can really try to develop those ones and develop the machinery so it could be exported in a major way, as well as major metals such as copper, iron, as well as semi-precious to precious materials from gold to silver to very precious stones from emerald to lapis lazuli and rubies and many more. And then also, last but not least, it's the strategic materials such as lithium. Afghanistan has one of the largest reserves of lithium. I think Afghanistan's lithium and in Greenland's lithium might be the only two major sources that are not that Chinese mining companies do not own. And also having 14 of the 17 rare earth material. 14 of the 17 rare earth materials. So the whole strategy of how we can really try to extract these ones became the second key element. The third area was what to transport and how we can really do the trade. Given the location of Afghanistan being in a land bridge between India and as well as China and Europe, and not connecting Central Asia down to the warm waters of the Gulf area. These are the areas that country has really concentrated its effort in three areas. First of all, in terms of moving of goods, being along the path for the China's One Belt One Road. That's the planning for that has really began, and this is going to make a major impact in terms of moving of goods east west from as well as trying to connect from north south, because the closest warm ports from all of the Central Asian countries, from Kazakhstan to Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan, The former closest ports are port of Chabahar in Iran, as well as Gwadar in Pakistan. So a number of agreements have been already signed with along that line. Second area of moving was the movement of energy, because Central Asia has such a large amount of energy supplies, both in terms of natural gas, oil, as well as electricity. By contrast, South Asia has such a big need of that one. For instance, Pakistan alone has the need for more than 15,000 megawatts of power, and we've already began signing two major contracts to be able to do that. And the third area is movement of data. Some of the changes that was made in the past year was how to be able to open it up and break the government monopoly, so we can have the movement of data much easier. And if that is also done, I think the potential data revenue for transit will be over $1 billion just between north-south as well as east-west. But when you add that one plus the movement of energy and movement of goods, within a 10-year period, I think for the country having a revenue stream of over $3 billion in that area, it's not out of the question. The fourth area was the what to manufacture. And in terms of manufacturing, not only the availability of the human capital, but also the basic materials. The next area was places to be able to build these. One of the major benefits of the foreign forces that were in Afghanistan for over a decade, they have built a number of very modern bases, and those bases are huge. I mean, if the one in the southwest part of the country in Helmand, in terms of size, it's bigger than Dubai Airport, for instance. The one in Kandahar in the south was built to accommodate over 17,000 U.S. soldiers with all of the accommodations. So these sites, and there are about 7 or 8 of them all around the country, and these are great sites that could really be developed for special economic zones for exports purposes that could really employ a lot of the locals and be able to move the economy forward. So along those four key areas, a number of major elements that has already happened. Last year, we've completed the national infrastructure plan for the country, which included the plan for the railroads, for the power sector, for the first time developing a national grid for the country, and within 5 years to be able to get to self-sufficiency on electricity. For the roads, as well as the telecommunication systems, housing, and all of the other other key energy areas. Secondly, in terms of the human capital side, developing how we can really build the human capital for all of the needs of the country as we look to the future, and. Within that one, the key was how to really, other major important element of the country was in the past 13, 14 years, the level of corruption had really increased tremendously. I think the corruption, there is still quite a bit of it, but I think the fight that the government had really started has really began to pay off. Some of the major changes that happened, for instance, in the past 2 years, the government replaced more than 90 generals in the army, and they changed a good number of, I think, more than 80 judges. And the president appointed the first female judge to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, she lost by 8 votes, and ironically, those were the votes of 8 women. Women parliamentarians who did not show up for the day of the vote because they had been threatened. So, but next year the president has made a commitment to do his best to be able to appoint another woman to the Supreme Court, which and the number of women judges that has been appointed has been tremendous. Some other changes in that area was as they have made some of the changes in the laws to be able to have in the future deeds of properties will be bought in the name of the both spouses. The woman, so it will not only be in the name of the husband. We have done quite a bit in terms of in Transparency International last year. For the first time after 14 years, the ranking moved about 8 notches. That's still the first step in the right direction. I think that in this coming year, I think it's going to move much, much higher in that ranking. We're beginning to attract some private sector investment. If I can paraphrase the president, his view is that no country has gone from poverty to prosperity through international aid. It is usually through private sector investment. And last year, in the last 6 months of 2016, we were able to attract about $1.3 billion of investment, about $800 million of that one in the infrastructure area. So that has been some of the key changes that has happened in Afghanistan. In terms of the challenges that the country has, the challenges are quite a bit. But I think the will that people have is also quite strong. The road is going to be quite hard as we look towards the future. But I think Pa is, kind of end where I started, and that is, I would hope everyone can recognize and see that in terms of the fight that is going on in Afghanistan, it's not only the fight of Afghanistan. It's not a civil war by a long shot. It's primarily fighting the part of the global war on terror. When we talk about, I said, the highest concentration of over 20 global terrorist organizations fighting around Afghanistan, and the Afghan people are shedding their bloods on practically every night defending the Afghanistan. I think this is something that they are fighting as not only the Afghanistan's war, but basically the fight of all of the democratic societies. And in terms of the democracy, I think one of the things that we can take pride is that Afghanistan has the freest of press of the media for over 1,000-mile radius of Afghanistan. There's the only country in that part of the world that there is zero form of censorship of any form. And when you look at a country that 12 years ago, they had only one government government-run media. There are more than 100 TV stations and hundreds of radio stations with radio talks and whatever. I think that really shows, and that's what's the strength of the country, that in the long run, with all of the challenges, democracy not only would prevail, but it is, people have, this is what people want, and this is what has been driving the country. So with that, why don't I stop here, and thank you for this opportunity.
We want to thank again Dr. Mohammad Khayyomi for his talk on Afghanistan called Current Challenges, Afghanistan Current Challenges and Future Prospects. We want to remind our audience online and elsewhere that Dr. Khayyomi is an engineering professor who currently serves as the chief advisor on infrastructure and technology to the president of Afghanistan. And we should note that he's also the former head of the board of directors of the Commonwealth Club. This is the portion of the talk where we take questions from the audience, and we have a lot of really interesting questions from the audience. Grateful to that. One of the questions, I think this is a good question, actually, concerns your personal story, where you grew up and so forth. And I know you were born and raised in Kabul, and your mother, for example, I don't think even learned to read or write. Can you talk about your personal story and how, in a sense, it's a far journey, but I don't know how far really from your childhood in Kabul to the Bay Area, and then you go back to Afghanistan quite a bit now.
Okay, well, I was born and raised in a working family. My father had an elementary school education. My mother didn't have a chance to go to school, but My father had a deep interest in education and had made sure that me and all of my siblings get a good education. And we, all of us, had the chance to go to college. And after I finished my high school in Afghanistan, joined the university in Kabul, and that's when I got a scholarship to the American University of Beirut. After graduating from there, worked in Saudi and in Arabia and Emirates for 2 years, and then from there, I came to the U.S. For my graduate studies. That's the time that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, and my family had to leave Afghanistan soon after that. So practically, the only thing they had was their own, the clothes that they were wearing. They had to leave all of their belongings behind them. And so that's why, from all of my childhood, for the first 16 years, I don't have any memorabilia, even a picture or anything, because all of that, they had to leave all of that behind. So eventually, they came to the U.S. and migrated here, as well as my wife's family. My wife is also from Afghanistan. We met at the American University of Beirut, and she lives in the Bay Area, of course. She's a clinical dietitian as well as an Afghan poet. I did all of my studies in the U.S., and from the beginning, I had a deep interest in terms of what I can give back, so that's why I stayed in I joined higher education and spent 36 years in the U.S. higher education system, all of them in public institutions by choice. And to me, that was the way to give back to the society.
Well, two years ago, people would have found you at San Jose State University.
That's correct.
And they would have found you with very much an academic hat on. And you were had established a very good reputation for running universities and so forth. Okay. And now, people would find you in Kabul. And also here, though. Also here.
Sure, absolutely.
But so the extension of that question was, how did you go from running, a very prestigious university to helping to run a country that's very much in transition?
Well, I think part of it is that at different points of our lives, we may have different opportunities. And to me, this was a unique opportunity that I could help the country that I was born and raised, in a way, pay my dues there as well. But also, the fact that since the president of the country and I were classmates and college roommates, in a way that he made a call on me that I should come and help him and help the country that both of us were born and raised. So that I could not say no to that. And I've not regretted that, that decision that I've made. Spending long hours. I know the challenges are great over there, but I think I'm making a difference, and I hope some of that change will be felt not only today but in the future.
I'm struck by your talk about how optimistic you are and how matter of fact you are about the potential and opportunities in Afghanistan, and actually how much has changed there. An average media imbiber, shall we say, someone who watches TV news or even reads the paper, dare I say, would think that Afghanistan is on the brink of something maybe not catastrophic, but is really in a hard state right now. And lots of news reports of political doings that are not quite high-minded and so forth. Can you talk about the difference between the perception of Afghanistan and the reality?
Well, I think, whenever we are trying to cover the entire media with some sound bites or a Twitter message, it's kind of hard to get, regardless of the topic, it's kind of hard to get the whole issue through. So I think in some ways it's unfortunate that we do not see as many opportunities for dialogue and debate and for more in-depth coverages of what's really happening around the world. And I think not only looking at Afghanistan as only one country, but looking at the dynamics of Central Asia and South Asia and what's and the potential opportunities there, not only for that region, but also for the U.S. in that region. I think from a geopolitical importance, Central Asia has a tremendous level of importance for the U.S., as well as, you know, and also if you look at it from India to Israel, Afghanistan is the only country that is a foundational partner of the U.S. And also even if you look at all of those major bases that was built, you know, assuming that, you know, with all of the issues that are happening in the Middle East, what other place, the U.S. can really have a foundational partnership to really have a sense of presence for that area? You know, that from all kinds of practical reasons, Afghanistan looks the appropriate place to be.
Well, several questions about the new American president's approach to Afghanistan. And I know that Ashraf Ghani and President Trump spoke on the phone, I believe in the last week or two.
Twice, yeah. They spoke once when they were President Trump was still a president-elect, and then they spoke recently as well, yes. And there was a meeting was presented about 10 days ago, both with at the Munich Security Conference with Vice President Pence, as well as Defense Secretary Mattis.
Right. So I imagine the conversation partly has to do with troop levels and so forth. But can you give us some insight into maybe what they talked about?
I think the conversations, from what I know, the conversations were very much at high-level stages, not with a lot of specifics. Both leaders talked about the concern about the rise of the terrorism in that area and the joint fight against this terrorist organization. Also, President Trump talked about the opportunities in Afghanistan, specifically within the mining sector as one of the key areas where hopefully I think we can get the U.S. firms involved. Specifically, as I mentioned, some of these strategic materials when we talk about rare earth as well as lithium, for instance, which are which are not very important not only for the U.S. but specifically when we look at the Bay Area, being the capital of the world technology. I mean, lithium and rare earth materials are quite important for us.
One question, and I think this is meant in all earnestness, is whether the majority of the Afghan people consider the U.S. a reliable ally.
I think that by far, I'm sorry, did you?
No, it's so yeah, I think it's a really interesting question to ask.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the sentiment towards the U.S. is very positive. And I think, you know, what when I talked about this, the 4,600, young American soldiers who lost their lives, I think people have a deep connection to that one. And I think the feelings toward the U.S. has been positive and is quite positive till today.
You talked earlier about the perception of Afghanistan versus reality, and several questions from the audience relate to women in Afghanistan.
Yes.
And of course, under the Taliban, there was a lot of media coverage of the treatment, ill treatment of women,
yes.
the forcible wearing of burqas, et cetera, et cetera. And that subject was debated many, many weeks and months,
sure.
Years in this country. So one question is how women are faring in Afghanistan today. And another question related to that is what is the best strategy for improving women's rights in education in
sure.
Afghanistan?
Well, I think compared to where we were during the days of the Taliban, there were major changes that has happened that has been foundational, of course, in terms of, first of all, in terms of votes and women having the same right to vote as men. There's even a certain percentage of minimum number of women that have to be in the parliament, I think, as well as in the cabinets. We have four or five of the cabinet positions to be women. Of course, the president's being quite open about commitment to make sure that during his presidency to get a woman Supreme Court judge there. But I think more substantially, I think not. If you go back to those days of the Taliban, where there was no women were allowed to go to school, to over 6.5 million kids, girls in schools, and of course in all of the universities as well, but as well as all government offices and in all kinds of positions. But I think the more important element question there is: what can you know, for women to really have a sense of, you know, to really for the emancipation, we need the economic ability for women. We need them to be able to have the education so they can have the kind of jobs that they are interested and be able to have the key roles. I mean, the last element will be is what I mentioned earlier, and that was the what the current president has done is in terms of all of these areas where they're people giving people deed to their property. The deed for the first time is going to be both in the name of the husband and wife. In the past, the tradition was it was only in the name of the husband. So I think that's you know, that's an important change. Do we, you know, are there a lot of things that still needs to be done? Absolutely. I mean, and that's, you know, one of the other good things that have been is the First Lady has been championing that as well, and in terms of really getting a lot of the girls to schools and making sure that the level of education that they get is going to be so important. So, you know, just repeating what I said, in terms of the education, getting more opportunities for women for education, and making sure that they get to the skills in the in ways that they can have their own economic base. Those are the kind of key things that would be is of quite importance. And lastly, I know there was a new note that I saw where there's an, women groups are creating their own chambers of commerce, women chambers of commerce in different provinces. I think that's also another element that would really empower more women to have their own businesses, to be able to have the economic independence. That, to me, is a key path for emancipation for them.
I'll take a little break here and remind our listening and online audiences that we're listening to Dr. Mohammed Kayomi, and the talk is Afghanistan, Current Challenges and Future Prospects. One question concern from the audience concerns the poppy trade in Afghanistan, and of course that also was heavily covered in the media during the Taliban rule.
Correct.
Partly because they were using the crop as a cash crop to keep their administration going. The question really concerns whether the Afghan government is kind of condones, you know, the growing of poppies, knowing that ultimately a lot of it's geared toward illicit drugs, and how difficult that is because it does raise a lot of money.
You're absolutely right. It is raising a lot of money. It's still a problem in Afghanistan. The government has been fighting to be able to reduce that one. But part of it is, you know, we have to look at the key source of the poppy, as I mentioned in my comments. As part of that $1.7 trillion of illicit activities globally, it starts from drugs to human trafficking to global terrorism. It's all part of the same continuum. It's true that though drugs is one of the sources of income for the Taliban. And in many ways, you can look at who are the Taliban. Are they any kind of a freedom fighter, or they're basically major part of a global drug cartel? I think part of there has been a lot of programs in the past 14 years in combating growing of poppies, but there has been, in my view, I spoke about this with the U.S. Embassy in Afghanistan about a month ago, and it, basically, to me, there are some key issues. First of all, when we talk about how in terms of raising poppies. Those individuals have been able to create such an integrated system where they provide the financing for the poppy growers, and then when it, and also grazing poppies is relatively easy because it's a drought-resistant plant that does not require a lot of water and it does not require a lot of caretaking, and then they come and even pick it up from their farm. So in a way, they have a very integrated supply chain. By contrast, all of the programs that starts by international agencies or whatever, they do not provide, you know, they might just give them some the seeds for some alternate crop without all of the know-how, without all of the financing in the upfront, or without ways to get them to the market. I mean, in a way, one of the problem with most of the fragile and then poor states are lack of market. In a way, over 4 billion people globally do not have access to markets. So I think it's not only finding the alternate crops. I mean, in some ways, in terms of the money, the resource, the harvest, the dollar wise, when you raise, for instance, pistachio or saffron or whatever, it's close to, in terms of value, close to the poppies. Not as, but part of it is that your saffron might be stuck somewhere, and without the market or without all the whole chain to be able to get it to the market, or getting the financing so you can have, you'll be able to sustain yourself till to get to that part. So I think those are part of it, that we have to look at these as part of an entire chain. Then lastly, it's usually, and if you look at it all across the world, countries that are raising poppies are countries where they have, I think, a GDP of less than $700 or so. If you're able to raise the overall economic capabilities of people, that's one of the things that has been, you know, that has reduced the growing of poppy. So I think these we have to look at them not at just one specific element, but look at the whole ecosystem and how we can look at address all of these issues to be able to reduce the growth of poppies. Otherwise, we're just doing a fight that will never change much, because in reality, with all of the money that has been spent in the last 14 years, we have seen ups and downs, but the total amount of poppy growth has not really dropped in any significant way.
One question from the audience relates to the level of corruption in Afghanistan. Now, Afghanistan, yeah, on the corruption scale is, I think, fairly high up there. And the ruling the regime of Hamid Karzai was known for its fair level of corruption, but also tolerance. I think he was put in a very difficult position, and now Ashraf Ghani has inherited, in some sense, that same level of corruption. How has he dealt with it? And is that, in some sense, is it an impossible impediment in Afghanistan?
I don't think it's an impossible impediment in Afghanistan. I think, yes, it's going to take a while, yes, because all of these corruption is one of those elements it's a network issue. It's not one element. It's, you know, how all of these elements really got connected. But where he started first was on the procurement side, because recognizing that, you know, procurement is one of the key areas in the government that, that when you have billions of dollars that go through that system, how they are really procured and whatever. So he created a National Procurement Council that he presides himself, and all of these major government contracts are going through that. In the first year, they were able to save, just in terms of the army procurement, several hundred million dollars of the procurement that was saved. As now, similar for the police, they have not had as much success, but and as part of it, they were able to give some priority for local production. That's how the country was able to get to self-sufficiency on about seven or eight of different key products. I mean, one not necessarily the most healthy of products. If you look at in 2014, Afghanistan was importing $500 million worth of soft drinks. Today, Afghanistan actually exports $200 million of soft drinks. Of course, it's not the healthiest thing, but unfortunately, people are still using them. But I think, you know, that has been part of it, is by giving more and more some preference, about 25% preference for local products, they have been able to get more and more and grow more of the local economy and be able to have it in a more transparent way. So that has been on the procurement side. The next area that he's starting is on the whole recruitment side for the government. There are some new changes that are happening there. But and when I talked about the changes of many of these generals and also major changes in the in the court system. I think, you know, more than 80 judges were replaced, and a number of government people that was caught red-handed. I mean, they were, and now even a minister has been put on, was suspended, and they've created a separate court, and the government had made commitment that before they will talk about and investigate those who were in the prior regime, they want to make sure that they can clean up those who are in the current regime before they look at the form. So have they made some major changes? Yes. Is there a lot more that needs to be done? Absolutely. But I think the trajectory that has put in place is the right one. As I mentioned, they have, in terms of the Transparency International, the country moved about 8 countries. You know, it's still in the bottom quartile. But I think when you see the data from 2016 that has not been published yet, I think the changes is going to be much bigger. But the fight still has to continue for a good while to be able to raise the country to at par with most responsible areas of the world.
Can you talk? You mentioned earlier about a talk you gave at the American Embassy, I guess, in Kabul.
Yeah,
is that right? Can you talk about maybe there's a more personal story where you're, say, on the streets of Kabul, you know, or somewhere where people recognize you as, you know, part of, you know, the American Academy almost, and might even say, you know, Dr. Kayomi, please help us here. Is there a personal story that, in a sense, reflects the transition that Afghanistan is going through and also the potential?
I think the potential is in... I think for some, you know, the comments once in a while I've heard for some is the fact that I left a comfortable life and come and try to, you know, to help Afghanistan while I was away for 47 years. You know, that's, you know, actually there is some who have told me that, especially the youth, that it has inspired them to study more. It has inspired them to, you know, to be more hopeful and be more engaged. I think I've run into that a few times. But I think, you know, part of it is that as any person, try to do what one can do. I think every bit helps, and it's the collective efforts. There is a saying in Afghanistan that, you know, if you add many drops, you can make an ocean. And I think if it's individual drops that can, you know, individual deed of or acts of good help can eventually, you know, can make a, the collective impact of it is going to be great.
You mentioned that you and Ashraf Ghani were college roommates.
Yes.
Is that right? Is this at the American University of Beirut?
Correct.
Okay. So when you were studying there in Beirut and all the world seemed possible, yeah. Even though Afghanistan was going through, I think, a civil, you know...
No, it wasn't. No, it was during the days of the monarch.
Oh, the monarch, okay. Yeah. So what was Ashraf Ghani like then? Was he of the mindset that he could be president of the country, or did he just want to go off and,
I don't think he, at that time, the idea of whether he would be the president, but... He was always very serious and very much dedicated on what he can do for Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. So, from a very young age, that was his intention, and that's and the areas of his concentration really kind of reflected that.
And one question from the audience is asking you to please describe the working relationship between President Ghani and the Vice President. I believe that's a reference to Dostum. I could be wrong, but
the vice president right now has not been feeling well. I think he's I think the relationship I don't know anything specifically about the relationship.
Okay, because I know one of the headlines of the last week or so. Mm-hmm. Afghan troops and others surrounding the home of Vice President Abdul Rashid Dostum, and who's accused of orchestrating the kidnapping of a political opponent.
I know of that story. Those individuals, yeah, there was a number of his personal guards that were arrested. Yes,
right. But that's sort of the glass half empty, in a sense. Your talk was often about the glass half full. You're talking about the media coverage, but here's an example of something that seems really, sort of.
Well, I think where I would like to look at it is look at that. Even the person is the vice president, mm-hmm. but he's not above the law.
Mm-hmm.
There's an accusation, and the attorney general has found enough evidence that led him to go and arrest a number of his bodyguards. So I think to me that you look at it is the supremacy of the law and the fact that there is due process. And those individuals, after the investigations, those individuals were arrested. I think I would look at it as part of the glass half full rather than glass half empty, though.
Okay. One question from the audience concerns Afghanistan's neighbors and how they've influenced the country. I know India has long had its eyes on Afghanistan, and of course Pakistan. But also the question, relates to China and Iran. I know in the last couple of weeks I've read reports about Chinese troops being in Afghanistan as advisors of some kind. Can you talk about that? The kind of the neighboring countries that want to get involved, for better or for worse?
I think, first of all, with India, the relationship and the friendship that has existed with India has existed for several millennia. That's, and that relationship has continued. I think what I'll start, before talking about the in specifics, my comment will be is that if you look at the relationship among countries and their neighbors, democracies like strong neighbors and dictatorships like weak neighbors. So I think from that comment, you can really judge the relationship of Afghanistan with, especially of our eastern and western neighbor. Unfortunately, I think specifically the challenges that we've had with Pakistan has been the fact that to some extent, the rivalry that they have had with Pakistan, India, and plus the fact that they have harbored the Taliban and all of these, these terrorist organizations. I think any country that believes that there are good terrorists and bad terrorists really put themselves into jeopardy in the long run. I think that terrorists are terrorists. And when they try to, so that's where I think countries get themselves into a position of state-sponsored terrorism, which I don't think it's good for them or good for the region or the area as a whole. Now, by contrast, when I look at the relationship of Afghanistan with our northern neighbors, the three states, Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan, has been great. With Uzbekistan, especially with the change of the leadership, there has been a number of high-level visits and there are a lot of negotiations now to increase trade and transit. The relationship with China has been quite good, and there are a number of different areas that the Chinese are interested in investing and in helping in Afghanistan. And as I mentioned in my speech, Afghanistan is going to be part of the path for the One Belt One Road that will be going through Afghanistan, which will be important for Afghanistan as well as important for China.
We want to remind our audience online and listening that you're listening to Dr. Mohammad Qayyumi, an advisor to Afghan President Ashraf Ghani. And his talk tonight was Afghanistan, Current Challenges and Future Prospects. What's your own future hold for you? I mean, you're going to be an advisor for as long as Ashraf Ghani is in office. Or what is your own?
I think I've looked at every other jobs that I've had. I've always taken the jobs when I have felt that I can make a difference and I enjoy what I'm doing. I'm putting long hours. Conditions sometimes are tough. But I enjoy what I'm doing because I think I'm making a difference. And as long as I'm in good health and I can do that one, I would like to continue.
And does your position entail meeting in Washington with U.S. government officials?
Yes, I go to Washington periodically and meet with some of the members of the Congress and members of the administration. Sure.
Just out of curiosity, can you describe a meeting with maybe a recent meeting with a congressperson about and what what was discussed, and perhaps what was this person's big interest in Afghanistan, or do you find yourself having to get them interested, or are they interested regardless?
I think a number of us, senior senators and congressmen, has been quite interested in Afghanistan and supportive and recognizing the importance of what's the challenge in Afghanistan and how the fight in Afghanistan is so critical, not only for the Afghanistan but the region and even in the U.S. as a whole. I mean, specifically, the last meeting was during the Munich Security Conference. There was a number of senators, including Senator John McCain as well as Senator Lindsey Graham. I think their support to Afghanistan has been great, and have really believed in the fight of Afghanistan against global terrorism, and why it's so critical for the U.S. to strongly support the struggle in Afghanistan.
This may be our last question. You talked about your wife and your partner, who is I think you mentioned that she's a devotee of Persian poetry, Afghan poetry,
yeah.
Right? Is there, in your mind, a poem, an Afghan poem that really kind of symbolizes the potential and future of Afghanistan? Maybe it's a poem that you learned in childhood or not, but something that really captures the kind of hopeful feeling you have right now.
I think there is a lot, Persian poetry has been, Persian poets have been quite prolific. And in fact, even my wife just finished her fifth book on Persian poetry, and this book is all on Afghanistan, actually. So I think a lot of that poetry has this, shows the pride in the long history that of Afghanistan, recognizing the struggles that they have had, but also the hope that tomorrow will be better than yesterday. I think that's the kind of the nature of a good amount of the poetry that I grew up with. Although I studied engineering and not followed the humanities, but I still the love of poetry is something that has always been with me. But poetry has always been one of those elements traditionally that had been used in terms of raising people's emotions and getting them more emotionally attached to the country and to the future. So, poetry has played a very major role in the life of the Afghan people. And in terms of money gatherings or whatever, reciting poetry is a commonplace, even among the Afghan American community in the Bay Area.
And I guess you would say there's poetry in your job and in rebuilding Afghanistan.
I think so.
On that note, we want to thank Dr. Mohammad Qayyumi for his presentation today. His presentation was Afghanistan, Current Challenges and Future Prospects. We want to also really thank our audiences here for great questions. And we want to thank those listening to the recording and on the internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel, your moderator for the program, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 112 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.